The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Thanks to everyone who supports the show over on Patreon. Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, 6 Feet Under, Romy and Michelle, and American Beauty. My guest this week is Scott, host of the podcast The Movies That Made Us Gay. His first glimpse at gay life was the same-sex couple on the show 6 Feet Under, which inspired him to formulate an escape plan from his small Montana home with his sights set on Hollywood. The plan was to find his way into the entertainment industry, but all that changed shortly after he arrived and met the man who would one day become his husband. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, I want to give you a heads up that I've got a new video coming this weekend over on YouTube, all about TV gay bars and the unexpected reason that the macho crime-finding studs of Starsky and Hutch transformed into the grandmotherly Jessica Fletcher on Murder, She Wrote. Check out my YouTube for that and head over to Patreon to see some bonus videos. And just a quick reminder that I've got a little newsletter where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on. Sign up for that at mattbaume.com. Also, a big thanks to everybody who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon and to everyone who's reviewed it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's Scott. Well, this week I'm talking to Scott, host of the Movies That Made Us Gay podcast. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hello.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I have a whole podcast about influential movies from when I was a child and a young adult that kind of influenced my young gay life. But what about TV? Like, I don't really talk about television on our show. Like, we have some kind of side conversations about TV, but we tend to usually just focus on movies. So I recently got a coworker of mine at Trader Joe's into 6 Feet Under, and she's just loving it. And then I was just kind of thinking at work, 6 Feet Under had a profound effect on me as a young person. I probably started it when I was 17 years old, and I kind of watched it all throughout college. And it really sort of changed my life.
That's, you know, we've never, I don't think, talked about 6 Feet Under on Sewers of Paris. And it's kind of funny because I remember when it was on, there was a gay couple and it was a big deal and it was really groundbreaking. And it also, like, the show, I think, just turned 20 years old, like, last week or last month.
In June.
So let's talk about that show. I mean, first of all, like, what is it and why was it so important to you?
Yeah, of course. Well, it's an American drama television series that aired on HBO in 2001 to 2005, and it was produced by Alan Ball. And I suppose that when we get into this discussion, we should probably start with Alan Ball. Alan Ball was a big TV writer and film writer in the late 90s. He won an Oscar for American Beauty, and that just sort of catapulted his career as this gay writer in Hollywood that he had worked on numerous sitcoms, one called Oh Grow Up, which was a one-season sitcom. It was canceled the year American Beauty came out. And then he also wrote on Sybil and Grace Under Fire. And I think that he's been very vocal of just how unhappy he was writing sitcom television. And it just sort of, that just sort of percolated the idea of American Beauty when he wrote it, that this is kind of, this is the writings of a gay man that was very unhappy with his life. And then out came a movie like American Beauty, which American Beauty is kind of one of those movies that we don't really like to talk about a lot in 2021, just because there are certain things like Kevin Spacey, certain themes of that movie that, I mean, we've kind of grown past a little bit. But I mean, American Beauty was a huge hit. Like, it won Best Picture, it won him an Oscar, and it essentially got him the show 6 Feet Under.
Okay. I didn't know that there was any connection between those things. My most vivid memory of American Beauty is seeing it with some friends. So we went to see Fight Club, and then we snuck from Fight Club into American Beauty. And at first we were kind of struck by how similar they were and that they were both about middle-aged dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. And then when it got to the part of American Beauty where this high school kid is showing his friend this incredibly profound movie, home video that he made that like sums up what he thinks is the meaning of life. And it's a plastic bag blowing in the wind. One of my friends just started laughing uncontrollably because it's such a
such a sincere monologue that Wes Bentley has about this plastic bag. And it was just, I mean, everybody was talking about that scene. In 99.
And I can't remember if we were talking about it, like, can you believe this movie has, like, the nerve to think that there's something profound about this? Were we making fun of it then? Or were people like, it's so beautiful?
I mean, it's one of those things that I'm kind of putting myself back when I first watched it when I was, like, 14, 15 years old. And I just thought that it was like the deepest thing I'd ever seen. And it's one of those things that you kind of look back on it and it's so sincere that it is a little laughable. But I mean, I thought it was very deep watching it as a teenager.
I think I did too. I think I was like sympathetic with the movie, or maybe empathetic with the movie,
yeah.
Where I was like, okay, I'm going along with him and I see why he feels like this is meaningful and I can see why it's resonant. And then my friend laughing is what really, like, I think I'm grateful to him for doing that because it really pulled me out to be like, wait a minute, examine this. Is this really meaningful?
Yeah.
Or is it just like pretty to think that it's meaningful? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I feel like Kimmy Schmidt kind of rehabilitated that whole scene. But like, there's a joke on Kimmy Schmidt where she's like, this is a long story just for a sitcom joke. But somebody's like, oh my God, I really do feel like a plastic bag. And like, it's kind of funny, but kind of sincere. And I think that's the right balance that you need for something like that. Mm-hmm. It's just, anyway, it's not there in American Beauty. But so that movie happened. People loved it. And Annette Bening got turned into a meme for, I'm going to sell this house. And then
lost the Oscar to Hilary Swank, not once, but twice, you know.
Really?
We know the whole story.
Was that for Boys Don't Cry?
She lost for Boys Don't Cry. She was nominated that year for American Beauty. And then 2004, she lost to Hilary Swank when she was in Being Julia.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And Hilary won for Million Dollar Baby.
Oh yeah. Wow. This is a real time machine.
Yeah.
Okay. So, then this guy who I've never heard his name before. So I didn't know, like, there's this whole story about this guy behind these two things gets 6 feet Under. And so what is 6 feet Under and why does he make it?
So HBO just approached him of, we really want to work with you. You're really hot right now. We have an idea at the network that we want to do a show about a funeral home that just revolves around this family that runs a funeral home in Los Angeles. And Alan Ball was like, great, I got it. So he wrote the pilot. And I believe that one of the big feedbacks for the pilot was, can you just kind of make it a little more fucked up? And he was like, okay, which is kind of a very odd note from a network that, like, you need to go even further with it. And he wrote the pilot of 6 feet Under. So 6 feet Under, the show, follows the lives of the Fisher family who run a funeral home in Los Angeles. When Nathaniel Fisher Sr., played by Richard Jenkins, dies in the first episode, he gets hit by a car. He's smoking a cigarette in his car, probably stoned, and he gets hit by a bus. And then his sons Nate and David end up not selling the family business, and they decide to take it over. And there's Ruth, played by Frances Fisher, the widower of Nathaniel. So there's that character. There's also Brenda, who is a woman that Nate meets at the airport on his way home, because all of this happens on Christmas Day. Nate is coming back home for Christmas and his dad dies on Christmas. So it's kind of, this pilot sets up that these brothers are going to take over the family business. And just the series just kind of goes in and out of their lives and their relationships and them running this funeral home. There's Claire, played by Lauren Ambrose, who's kind of the youngest daughter of the family who graduates high school and is kind of navigating her way through young adulthood and trying to become an artist. And I guess the big storyline that always stuck with me, obviously, because I was like a in-the-closet teenager at the time, was David Fisher's storyline with his boyfriend Keith, who is a cop.
Okay, this is starting to sound familiar. This is coming back to me. So how old were you, and were you open, like, were you out to yourself at least, or out to other people?
Oh, definitely not out to other people. I mean, just definitely that sense of being a closeted teenager, that you're still kind of realizing, well, I think that I'm gay, but I'm not really sure. And there was something about seeing David's coming out story, because he does end up coming out to his family in season one, and just sort of his journey of being a little more comfortable with himself, that, like, it's okay to act gay in front of other people or present being gay. Like, it's okay. And just sort of seeing that as a young person definitely was a huge deal of, like, okay, this is going to be stuff that I'm going to have to deal with. I mean, it's funny that I say when getting older, but it's just like, clearly you could have used David's story like back then, but I was definitely a little too scared to do it.
Well, so what was your situation? Like, where were you growing up? And
so
What was keeping you in the closet?
So I'm from a small town in central Montana, probably population 7,000, little town called Lewistown, Montana. Just, yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that you just didn't see a lot of gay representation growing up in a small town. Yeah, I mean, you're just sort of cut off from a lot of America that you just didn't really see outside of television the lives of anyone gay. And this show kind of opened me up to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think, like, when, like, how did I first get a hold of a copy of 6 Feet Under? Because we didn't have HBO. We had just, like, the basic television channels off of, like, rabbit ears. But I think that I rented them from the video store that I later worked at. And this was kind of the beginning time of, like, DVD on TV on DVD. And when that was sort of becoming a big thing of that, you could miss it in its initial run, but you could catch up on DVD though.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I watched the first season on Christmas break, and then I would have to wait for each season to come out. Like, and it would be probably within a year that they would release each season on DVD.
And tell me about the gay couple. There was like I think it was the member of the family and his cop boyfriend, right?
Yes. David Fisher and his boyfriend, Keith. David Fisher played by Michael C. Hall, mm-hmm. and Keith played by Michael St. Patrick.
Okay. Yeah. And as I recall, they're an interracial couple too. Mm-hmm. So there's like, it's like doubly or triply something that you normally would not be seeing
definitely.
On television.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have people that you were like watching the show with, or was it like just your thing?
I think I introduced my family to it. So I got like my mom and my stepdad and my sister, I would watch it with her in college. And it's one of those things that I don't even think that my parents had even seen a show like 6 Feet Under that had an out gay couple in it. I mean, my stepdad, I mean, went to Berkeley in the 60s. So he definitely knew, was around the gay community when he was younger, but probably not my mom because she's from central Montana, has only lived there. So I kind of think that maybe the show kind of made them a little more comfortable with having a gay son that would later come out to them. I don't know. I really haven't discussed it with them.
Were there moments with that couple that like stuck with you? Like, were there memorable things where you're like, I don't know, were you learning like, what does it mean to be gay? Like they're my role models.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of David's journey of becoming comfortable with himself. And I mean, David's only holding himself back. That it's okay to be open about it with your family because the reactions might surprise you. Because there's there's kind of all of these moments with Ruth, who's his mother, of that, you know, I think she's kind of fine with him being gay. And it's all of David's personal hangups that he's kind of holding himself back of having this relationship with his mother and being open. So I think that was kind of a big lesson with the journey of Michael C. Hall's character, of that when you come out to your family, some of them might surprise you of just how well they receive it.
Were you holding yourself back?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I didn't come out until I was in my early 20s in college, so it still took me a number of years to get comfortable with myself, yeah.
What eventually did that? Like, I guess 6 Feet Under was kind of a start, but like...
It was just kind of a start, and I just remember I was always very focused on schoolwork in college that I just didn't feel like this is something that I just have to deal with later. And I remember there was an exact moment when I was driving to Bozeman from Missoula, where I was going to college, that I'm just like, why am I like so hung up on this? It's just like, I'm going to start like living my most authentic life as like the self-help books say. And that was just kind of the moment that changed. I remember I was in the car just thinking like, why am I holding myself back? Like, I cannot name any reasons why. Like, I have a very loving and supporting family. All of my friends would be cool with it. Like, why? So it's just sort of, it's one of those moments that really click.
Where were you coming from when you had that realization?
I was on the road. I was driving to Bozeman at the time. I think that I was just seeing friends. I was just driving on the highway. Yeah.
You'd like left college to go see friends, or you'd left home to go see friends?
I left college to go see friends. It was just like a weekend.
Mm-hmm. And then like when you got to your friends, were you like, I've had an epiphany?
I think I ended up coming out to one of my friends there. And that was one of the first big friends that I told. And then you just kind of slowly ease yourself out all throughout college. And yeah, I mean, it just sort of progressed.
How did people respond?
Everybody responded great. Like, there was no pushback at all from at least the major family members.
What was going through your head with, like, that first friend? Like, you're driving, you're like, what's holding me back? Nothing's holding me back. I'm going to do it. Like, that first person that you came out to, do you remember what was, like, going through your head or what you felt?
It was just one of those things that just sort of spitting it out for yourself and putting it into words with someone that you care about.
Sounds like it was probably a relief to start doing that.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then kind of going back to a character like David, that's sort of David's journey that he's on throughout the series of being comfortable with himself. And it's interesting that when I go back and revisit the show as an adult, I'm not really like David at all. Like, David sort of on the outside is very conservative. Like, he's not your typical gay character. Like, he presents very conservative, which was not really me as a young person. And it's one of those things that if I were to meet a couple like David and Keith now as friends, like, what would I think of them? I kind of think that they would maybe drive me a little crazy. Like, I don't think that I would probably be friends with them. And that's just kind of interesting that you just sort of need life experience to kind of draw conclusions like that as a character. Because you, when you watch this as like young people, as like a young person, you think, oh yeah, well, of course I would hang out with someone like David and Keith. But then it's just one of those things that when you kind of live in a city like Los Angeles, like, would I be friends with people like this now? Probably not.
I mean, my memory is, that one of them is kind of conservative and at least very, like, repressed and not particularly fun. And then the other is a cop. And so there's complicated feelings about that. Mm-hmm. I think maybe one of the reasons that I wasn't really excited about watching the show or really getting to know it was that they really seemed like they were written to be model minorities.
Sure. Which I totally get that now, revisiting it.
Did you base, like, what you thought a gay person should be, like, on, like, as you were coming out and you're like, okay, what does it mean that I'm gay? Like, this is who I am now, but so what? Like, how much of that was, I don't know, a process of discovery, and how much of it was based on the examples that you were seeing on screen?
I mean, yeah, definitely. Especially that these characters live in a city like Los Angeles, and Los Angeles has every gay person that you can possibly think of. And you're only seeing very specific portrayals on a show like Six Feet Under. And that's one of those things that I didn't really get. I didn't really get until I lived here, of just all of the types of gay men that live in this city, that sort of basing it off of people like David and Keith are just, it's just kind of basic. Like, there's a lot of different types of guys out there, or of gay guys out there. So yeah.
What was gay life like for you, like, back in Montana, like, after you started coming out?
I mean, it's probably one of those things now that a state like Montana and the bigger college towns have sort of a bigger gay scene that wasn't really there in the mid-2000s when I lived there. I mean, I'm sure that it was there when you really looked at it, but it was pretty non-existent. That I still just hang out. I still hung out with primarily straight people, which is fine. I have great straight friends, but it's one of those things that you didn't really have gay bars, gay nights anywhere. And you just didn't really have a sense of community until I moved to a place like Los Angeles. And that was probably my big choice of why I have to leave that state. And it's one of those things now, I think that probably the college towns have really progressed, that there is sort of kind of room for everybody now, that it's a little more accepting than it was, say, 15 years ago, too. Mm.
Yeah. So, like, were you just sort of, I don't know, it feels kind of like you're lost in the woods, maybe? Like,
yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that I knew from a very young age that I couldn't stay in Montana. I could go to college there, but I was not going to live my life in Montana. Like, I already had my escape plan, like, made out, that it was something that I had to prepare myself all throughout college, that I'm going to move to Los Angeles and never come back. I mean, maybe it was just kind of my personal journey, that maybe I could be more of myself in a place like Los Angeles, and kind of looking back and, like, clearly I could have been myself in a place like Montana. Like, if I really tried hard, like, I could have made it work. But I knew that I needed just a change of geography to a place like Los Angeles.
Was it just the small towniness, and there weren't other people like you that you could find in Montana?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
So what was your escape plan?
It was just one of those things that I finished college. I went to radio television school. I got an internship in Los Angeles. I saved up for it. My parents very generously helped me that I wouldn't have been able to make it without their help. And I moved the week after I graduated college. I packed up my car. I didn't really know anyone in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I moved here and I've been here ever since. It's where I met my husband, Pete. I met Pete through the job that I got from the internship. And we've been together for 10 years this December. So pretty much I met him not too long after I moved out here. And we've been married for almost 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about like landing in LA. Like you drive your car there, you're in the
city.
Oh,
it's a trip.
And then what?
It's crazy. It's one of those things that I was staying with friends of my stepsister at the time, which nice guys, but I wasn't really friends with them. So it was more like I'm just living at their apartment as I kind of get set up in the city. And yeah, driving down like the 101, I'd never been in a city quite like this, that the towns in Montana are nothing like Los Angeles. And yeah, it was trip, just kind of going to the city by yourself. I'm going to try to make a life for myself here. And kind of relating it back to a show like 6 Feet Under, I remember at the time, I could really relate to Lauren Ambrose's journey that she had at the very end of the show. Because Lauren Ambrose's character, Claire, pretty much packs up her car and just moves to New York. I think that she gets a job there that just fell through, but she just decides, I'm still going to go because this is just something that I have to do. Like, I have to get out of this town and make a life for myself. And there's this really beautiful shot of Claire driving down the highway in the desert. It's in like right before the big montage of how 6 Feet Under ends. And it's Claire just driving her hearse. Well, I guess she's not driving her hearse. She's since upgraded to like a Prius, I think. She's not driving her iconic hearse anymore. And it's just this beautiful image of Claire driving down the highway, just sort of driving into her future. And I definitely remember thinking of that as I was driving to Los Angeles.
My own like arrival, the first time that I when I moved to LA and many years ago, I remember like feeling just incredibly small because, I mean, for one thing, definitely. The freeways are just insanely wide. They're like the biggest freeways I've ever seen.
I was never used to driving anywhere past like three lanes.
And then the city itself, like, you know, I hesitate to call it a city exactly because it's
massive.
A bunch of suburbs kind of glued together. But it's just Los Angeles just keeps going and going and going. And you're like, okay, when do I get to the city part? And it's just like you're in it all the time without realizing it.
And also just sort of whenever I would see kind of gay nightlife on television and movies, and then I end up moving to a city with gay nightlife, it's very different of when you actually go out as compared to like David and Keith going out to these like set dressed gay bars. Have you ever thought of that? Of just sort of how gay bars and gay clubs are portrayed in movies and TV as opposed to when you're actually there.
I'm obsessed with it. I'm working on a YouTube video about that. I found like this episode of Starsky and Hutch that's set at a gay bar and one of Murder, She Wrote. And then there's an episode of 30 Rock or Third Rock from the Sun. And TV gay bars set such a weird expectation of what you're actually going to find. What did you find? Like, what was your exploration of gay life in LA like?
Probably going out in Los Angeles when you first moved here, you always go to West Hollywood. That's just sort of where people take you of – like you're a 25-year-old, you want to go out and have fun, you always go out to West Hollywood. And I went out there a handful of times, but I really didn't get a good sense of the city until I met somebody like my husband, Pete. Pete's lived in Los Angeles his entire life. He's been going out for years. He's kind of done live music. He's been to all of the major gay bars. And Pete was definitely somebody good to know of all the West Hollywood stuff. You don't need that. You need to come to the East Side. I'm going to take you places like the Eagle or the Fault Line. Those are the real good times that I think that you'll like. And yeah, it's that weird Los Angeles dynamic of the West Side versus someplace like West Hollywood to East Los Angeles. And kind of East Los Angeles is kind of the place going out in LA that I feel a little more comfortable.
Tell me about East LA. Like, West Hollywood is very, I don't know, it's kind of like Disney World in that, like, it's a very, I don't know, manicured sort of gay bar experience. Like,
yeah, definitely.
There's a lot of intentionality about it being a clean sort of thing.
Yeah, if you want to go pay for like an overpriced gin and tonic at some place like the Abbey. I think that whenever we go out in Los Angeles, we always go to some place like the Eagle. We were just at the Eagle last night. It's nice to be back. Whenever you see stuff portrayed on TV, you never see stuff like regular people going to something like a leather bar. I don't think that I would ever see David and Keith on 6 Feet Under walking into some place like the Eagle. And I mean,
yeah. I'm trying to think of any depiction other than like cruising. Where has there ever been
cruising or something like the Blue Oyster from Police Academy?
Like, I can't think of a single leather bar. I mean, maybe something will come to me, but I can't think of a single depiction, like, or particularly an accurate one in anything.
Yeah. And also maybe it is kind of in the gay community in the 90s and early 2000s. Maybe it was just kind of a mixing of communities that wasn't as accepting of just sort of the West Hollywood types of gays tend to stay clear of a bar like the Eagle. I don't know. It just kind of took until like the mid-2000s for kind of mixing of communities and that to be a little more accepted. I don't know.
Yeah. Wow. I hadn't considered that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so you're going over to the west side, or no, you're going over to the east side now, and starting to explore that, and I guess sort of like divier bars, or at least bars where people are not quite so, you know, polished and plucked. And this is probably around the same time, like, you're doing your internship, right? And so you're kind of like learning showbiz stuff and getting into the industry.
Yeah. I mean, well, I ended up leaving the job that I was working at Barnes & Noble at the time, which I worked for 10 years, and now I'm at Trader Joe's, and now I just sort of do podcasting. I didn't quite get into the industry all that much. I do some entertainment writing on the side, but I ended up going from my job to a bookstore in retail, and then grocery work. I don't know. I have kind of an unusual journey.
What is the, the vision that you had for yourself? Like, when you said you went to, like, I think it was TV and radio school, and when you went to LA, what was the plan?
I think it was just sort of to break into the industry and move to a new city and just sort of, I don't know. It's something that I'm still kind of on, that I'm still kind of considering of where I might see myself. I get, I guess, comfortable at a certain job that I don't want to leave, like, pursue other things. So, I mean, that's kind of partially the reason why I'm doing my podcast, is just sort of to have an outlet for something like that as I do my nights at a grocery store too.
Mm-hmm. You said that one reason you wanted to leave Montana and come to LA was because you didn't feel like you could be yourself. Like, did that change? What was different in LA? And did you find yourself actually like, okay, now I'm living authentically? And what does that even mean?
The only thing that was holding myself back was me. It's like, I could have gone on this journey living at home in Montana, living in a city like Bozeman or Missoula, but I knew that I just needed a change of scenery. And I think that in a city like Los Angeles, I was just a little more comfortable being myself. I don't know if that really makes sense. I just felt like I needed a new space to have. Sorry.
What was different? Like, how, you know, when, if you went to, I don't know, bar or just hung out with friends.
You just kind of open yourself up to all of these types of people that you probably wouldn't have met living in a small town. That a state like Montana is very sheltered from the rest of the world. Everybody is primarily white. You don't really get a large diversity of who you're interacting with every day. And a city like Los Angeles is definitely very not that. It's very open to the rest of the world, I guess.
So, like, meeting lots of different kinds of people, did you start to figure out, like, who you were? And like, who was that? Like, how do you describe, like, the person that came to LA, and who was the person that you were as you were being like, okay, this is who I can actually, I'm living authentically.
Yeah, definitely. I could be a little more comfortable with myself, just kind of as my family and friends knew that I was an out gay man, that I was making a life for myself that was my own here. I just needed a city like Los Angeles to get me there.
Did you feel like a different person?
Definitely, yeah. I felt, well, I think maybe a more grown-up version of myself. That I knew that I had come a long ways, and I made a progress to the very kind of insular person that I was in college, that was kind of afraid to share anything about my personal life, my feelings, that I think that once I came to Los Angeles, I was a little more at ease with something like that.
And I imagine like meeting your like eventual husband probably helped you feel like this is a new life, this is a new start.
Yeah, definitely.
How did you meet and how did you figure out like, oh, there's something going on here?
I met Pete through friends at work, very close friends of Pete worked at my job. I worked at a place that cut movie trailers, and we were introduced by friends at the Christmas party. At the end of the year Christmas party in December, Pete was a guest of a friend of ours that worked there. And Pete's best friend worked in the finishing department at this company. And it was just sort of, you two should talk. I had just met Pete's friend's now wife, who was his girlfriend. She was his girlfriend then. And it was just kind of, you two should meet. And we just kind of hit it off. And I feel like I've been like making the trek to Pasadena ever since. I moved to Pasadena probably about 7 months after I met Pete, and I've been here ever since. Mm-hmm.
So you just met the woman who he was dating, and yeah.
I don't know if it was like on purpose of like, we're going to like hook these two up, but it just kind of happened. Like
okay.
When we met at the party, like we just hit it off, and yeah.
Do you remember what you talked about?
I remember our first official date was at the Cha-Cha Lounge in Los Angeles. And we just talked about movies and television. I remember talking about our love for old episodes of 90210 and Shannen Doherty. Weird segues into just these very specific areas of pop culture came up, like how we think the Gus Van Sant Psycho is very underrated and how that's very unusual to meet somebody that has similar thoughts about something like that. When I remember just sitting at the bar, just having this conversation with Pete, and it was just the easiest thing in the world.
You know, something that sets, I think, Los Angeles and a few other states like New York apart is that there's such a level of media familiarity. Like it's really easy to find other people to talk to about certain, you know, things, even obscure stuff. And it's a good way to kind of talk about yourself without actually talking about yourself, but you are still talking about yourself because, you know, the language that you're using to describe, to, you know, talk about what, you know, express the things that you like and your opinions on them. It was really autobiographical, whatever your media diet is. Mm-hmm. And so you can be personal without actually talking about, you know, who you are as a person.
And I remember being very interested in that Pete was from LA, that Pete's not a transplant. He's lived here his entire life. So Pete was very familiar just with Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I got to kind of explore the city with him. And I think that Pete just enjoyed taking me around the city with just sort of a new set of eyes of someone that hasn't seen all of these areas of the city. Like Pete took me downtown. He took me to places like the Eagle. Just kind of all of these places that he could introduce somebody new to. I think that Pete really enjoyed that when we first met.
Yeah. So you're really there to explore, and it sounds like he was having a good time being your tour guide.
Yeah.
What do you have like places that you went that you were like, okay, this is great. This is like our place, or I don't know. This is some place that I'm so happy that you showed me.
Definitely places like the Eagle and the Fault Line, all of the major bars of Los Angeles, Akbar, I mean, we go to movies like multiple times a week, even especially pre-pandemic, we would see like at least a movie a week. So we would go to places like the Vista in Los Angeles, the Arclight, and go to movies. And that was just kind of a big thing that we used to do together.
What did you guys see?
I mean, that we still do with each other. I remember the first movie that we went to with each other was Sofia Coppola's Somewhere, which is funny because that movie is definitely something that I would have trouble dragging Pete to now. Pete loves stuff like The Virgin Suicides, but I don't know if a movie like Somewhere with Stephen Dorff might be kind of a hard sell for him now, just because it sort of leans a little too heavy into being this art movie that Pete would probably roll his eyes at now. But I think that was our first movie that we saw together, was Somewhere.
Did you go to see a lot of, like, it sounds like you're kind of leaning towards, like, I don't know, more obscure or like dramatic or artistic, thinky movies?
I will drag Pete to anything. Like, anything that I'm interested in, I will make him see it with me.
Mm-hmm. Did you show him 6 Feet Under?
Pete has never really cared for 6 Feet Under. It's one of those things that I've mentioned the show to him. He's just be like, oh yeah, that show. I meant to watch it. I just kind of missed it. Kind of like you, but just didn't quite get along. Just didn't quite like watch it as it was airing. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things now that you get like 5 seasons. It's almost, I think it's like 75 episodes. So it's not even that long for a major series that it didn't hit 100 episodes or so. But I mean, stuff like that can be overwhelming. And I think that Pete is just like, I'm just not really going to watch it, which is fine.
I mean, it sounds like for you, it was really helpful in seeing other queer people on TV. And then, yeah. I don't know, for him, like growing up in LA, was he more comfortable? And he was like, I just don't need that.
Yeah, I think so. I think that Pete also gets that when he sees ethnic characters like the Freddie Rodriguez character, that this is a Latin American character probably written primarily by white people. And Pete can kind of call that out in like dialogue of just certain things that they say that maybe don't quite ring as true of someone that is from like East LA that went to high school and like downtown. So that's mm-hmm. just kind of one of those nitpicky things of somebody that's from Los Angeles that would have with a show like 6 Feet Under.
So tell me about the podcast stuff that you've done and like how that got started and what you've made. And also, you know, making it with Pete.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fun to have a creative outlet with my husband about something like this, that I've always loved listening to film podcasts. I remember when I first moved here, I was really into the IFC News podcast that sort of had a film subject every week. And they would talk about just sort of a certain theme and movies that they would recommend. And I remember sort of listening to that podcast. This is probably one of the first major podcasts that I listened to. I remember back then just the amount of work that I had to do to get a podcast on my iPod at the time. Like, you had to go to iTunes, you had to download it, you had to drop it in like a file on your iPod. And that's when you could listen to it as you were walking around, when you were just walking around doing errands and stuff. And I remember listening to this movie podcast when I first moved here and just thinking like, this would be so much fun to do, that it doesn't really click in your mind of this is a podcast. Like, you can do it too. This was kind of the early years of, this was like in 2010 when you really first started to see people recording podcasts. And it doesn't really click that this is something that you can do kind of in the years later. I mean, podcasting is so readily available to people that all you just need is an audio recorder. Mm-hmm. And that's like really all that you need. And then I think that it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago that I was really thinking of, I want to start one. And then we just made it happen, that we got all of the podcast equipment and we made it.
So what was the first show that you made?
I was a guest on a blog that I wrote for, that I would do movie reviews. I would have to call in to like a number, and it was like a podcast over the phone. So I was used to doing stuff like that, but we looked into getting all of the equipment. My husband's is kind of the more technical one. So he looked at just all of the recording stuff that we would need, and we just made the show happen. And that's kind of my big advice to people that say that they want to do a podcast. My biggest advice is just do it. Just like, I mean, kind of the only thing that's holding yourself back is you. Like, just do it. Like, get the podcast equipment and make it happen. And that's what we did. So we've been doing an episode a week for the past 2 years.
So what is the show? Like, what is it about?
And oh, of course. Yeah. So our show, Movies That Made Us Gay, sort of looks at all of the entertainment, primarily, like, we tend to focus on movies, the movies that sort of helped shape and change our lives as young gay people, that we do a very broad range of movies that just sort of we latched on to as young people, that we just sort of had impressions on, of just like the movies that made us realize of maybe we're a little different from all of the other children. When I was watching a movie like Overboard as a kid, and I would see the Kurt Russell scene with the, cabinets and the shelves and the cedar closets, and he's wearing that muscle tank, and just the way that he grabs his shirt, and you can see like his pec muscles of just like, there might be something about me that is a little different. So we look at a very broad scope of movies, that ones that you might not peg as a movie that quote unquote made us gay. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun to do the programming for our show. Our very first episode was Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion, which was a huge deal for me watching it as a young person. I mean, I kind of joke that like I've had the journey of those two characters of leaving of leaving their town and moving to someplace like Los Angeles, of that I'm getting out of my small town and I'm moving to the big city. And that's kind of, I mean, Romy and Michelle moved from Tucson, so I was moving from a small town in Montana, but that was just sort of, I always kind of saw myself with the lives of Romy and Michelle, of just sort of moving to the big city. I guess that I didn't have a best friend to move with. I had to do it by myself. So, yeah.
And then you found a best friend.
Yeah. And then I found a best friend. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think of 6 Feet Under as, I don't know, like, I'm saying this kind of jokingly, but kind of not, like a movie that made you gay, not that it like awakened a passion for men in you, but it's a movie that gave you like gayness as a thing that you could be.
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely something about seeing characters like David and Keith that, I'm not anything like these characters now, but they definitely made an impression on me. I also haven't really talked about just like the guest stars that 6 Feet Under had, that I'm just a huge fan of actresses. I think that it's just like, there's, I mean, nothing greater than just watching a great character actor on screen. And 6 Feet Under was filled with so many great guest stars, like Lily Taylor, Patricia Clarkson, Joanna Cassidy, just like these great character actors that were really given great material on a show like that too.
Yeah. So, and it sounds like it was also giving you sort of an education in gay icons.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at all that stuff that like you have in your life now, like what are the, like the shows and the movies that you feel like they're influencing like your day-to-day stuff?
I mean, we cover them every week on our podcast. For stuff like that, just kind of these movies that are just ingrained in our lives, that Pete and I will just yell out quotes to each other of all of these movies, just movies that we always reference. I mean, just stuff that we cover on our show all the time. I think that also a big thing with Pete and I of driving around a city like Los Angeles are just movie locations, just kind of walking down Hollywood Boulevard and just finding Vivian's apartment from Pretty Woman, or driving by the Baby Jane house, Pasadena. There's a lot of stuff that's shot in Pasadena. Like just walking by the Michael Myers house when I'm going to rent videos at Videotech, of just all of these moments of just all of these shooting locations from movies that I'm just surrounded by. And that if I were to be a child and I saw that as kind of me as an adult, I would have just thought that would be the coolest thing ever. And stuff like that still doesn't get old to me. Like, I still find it so incredibly cool that I'm surrounded by the locations of all of this entertainment that I grew up on. Like, do you kind of follow that?
Yeah. What do you think that kid who was growing up watching 6 Feet Under, like, what would he think of what you're doing now?
It's one of those things that I always knew that I would move away, but I don't really know if my mind would have grasped that I would be a out gay man living with my husband. I just don't really know what, if that was really going through my mind that that was an option, but I just kind of needed that journey to get there. Like, it's not really something that I really could fully grasp that I could be living. And I just sort of discovered it for myself.
Fantastic. Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining me.
Of course. Yeah.
Thanks to Scott for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get back rewards, including a fun care pack in the mail. Check my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/MattBaum and my newsletter at MattBaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.